Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Mary Beth Albright is my guest today. She's a food expert who writes about how food affects our mental health. And she began her research when she worked at the Surgeon General's office with her mentor, Surgeon General C. Everett Koop. Her new book is Eat and Flourish: How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being. And I do want to stress this is not a diet book. It's a whole system approach. It takes a whole living look at how nutrition, environment, psychology, biology, and even pleasure work together to help alleviate depression, anxiety, stress, and more. So today we'll share cutting-edge research to explain the food-mood connection and how Mary Beth redefines emotional eating. We'll look at how to support emotional wellness through nutrition and pleasure. She stresses all the way through that food should be pleasure, so no harsh rules here. And we also look at the all-important gut-brain connection. So a little bit about Mary Beth Albright. She's a correspondent and editor at the Washington Post. She writes for Health Science, Food, Travel, and Bookworld. As she says, all the things that make life good. I would agree. She's also a public health attorney and has two award-winning video series, including Secret Table and Teach Dave to Cook. You can find out much more about her work at marybethalbright.com, including how she once tasted it, 2,000 foods in 3 days, 2,000 foods in 3 days to judge the Outstanding New Products Awards. And again, the name of the book is Eat and Flourish: How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being, and my guest, Mary Beth Albright. Mary Beth Albright, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Vicki. I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm pleased to have you here, pleased to look at the latest science around the topic we're talking about today. You know, as I said in the intro, you've been involved in food for many years. You've been a food attorney, a food judge. You were a finalist on Food Network Star, where you competed on Iron Chef of America. So, I mean, there's lots of fun stuff going on there, too. How did you first get involved in food? Why did it become a passion for you?
Oh, well, you know, I worked in public health almost my entire life, and I worked for the former U.S. Surgeon General, C. Everett Koop, who was Surgeon General in the 80s, but I worked for him in the 90s. And from that, I got such a great education in public health and a real respect for hard science and peer-reviewed evidence, and also a respect for, he was very interested in complementary and alternative medicine, which back, you know, 25, 30 years ago was what we called everything that wasn't a pharmaceutical, right?
Yeah.
So I got interested in all of those things, and so my journalism, my food policy work, all of it is with the intent of improving public health through food. And so it's been really just a thrill for me to write this book and to be involved in this conversation about food and emotions.
Yes, and this is an emerging science. I mean, I was listening to a doctor talk about this subject a couple of weeks back, and she said she feels like she's writing university papers every single day because the science is consistently changing. So I'm glad we have you with the latest here. One of the things I want to throw out there, because it's not just about science, it's also about pleasure. And Chef Carla Hall blurbed your book and said her takeaway was that I can eat both for pleasure and health at the same time. And that's good to know. That's good to know. So let's...
Oh, it's good news. Yeah, it's good news for those of us who really love food, right?
Yeah, really, really. So the book is called Eat and Flourish: How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being. And you say the premise of the book really is that all eating is emotional eating, and a whole food diet is essential for good mental health. So let's dive into how you would describe the book for listeners and who you wrote it for.
Sure. Well, I wrote it for a general audience, and even though my entire career has been focused on food, I like writing for people who aren't necessarily food people, right? I mean, I love writing for food people as well, but I know that there are a lot of things vying for our attention right now in this world, and sometimes it's easier to just eat mindlessly than to really think about what you're eating, and I get that. And so I really wanted to make a practical handbook that has evidence-based science about how you can improve emotional well-being through food for the general public. And, you know, the thesis of the book is that food and emotions are entwined, and we can either get to know that connection, that biological, inevitable connection, and how we can use it for greater health, or we can label it emotional eating and deny that it's there. You know, you can say like, oh, well, I feel happy and I feel like this kind of food, but I'm not going to pay attention to that because I'm working, I'm not being an emotional eater. And the thing is our biology has made sure that we will all always be emotional eaters. I mean, even people who, you know, Silicon Valley people who are like wired in and coding all day and just drinking meal replacements, they're still drinking either vanilla or chocolate or strawberry. You know, there's still a food preference there, and so that's really the core of the book.
Right, and I wonder if you'd just explain what nutritional psychology means, because it plays a very important part in our mental health too.
Yeah, and it goes by a lot of different names. Some people call it nutritional psychiatry. Some people call it nutritional psychology. And you see that when there's a new burgeoning medical field that all different people call it all different things until it really coalesces. But this, regardless of what you call it, the science is there and it's the same, which is that there is a food-mood connection that is grounded in science that means that we can use food to improve our emotional well-being and mental health. Now, it doesn't mean throw away your, you know, antidepressants. It doesn't mean you can say goodbye to your talk therapist. All those are evidence-based tools for dealing with emotional well-being as well. But we need to have as many tools in the toolbox as we can right now. I think we all know about the stories that we've heard about the mental health crisis in the United States and really globally, of mm-hmm. course, with the global pandemic. And when you look at those numbers, and those are just people who have been diagnosed with mental health disorders or emotional problems. And so it's really critical that we have all the tools that we can get. So nutritional psychiatry or nutritional psychology is just the study of how food can be used to enhance our emotional well-being.
Yes, and it's really interesting because when I was going through your book, I recognized, and I kind of knew this before, I guess, but I recognized because I had more free time, I wasn't going out during the pandemic, how much baking I was doing, and I hadn't baked for like years, and how that had an effect on not only my waistline, but I also got addicted to sugar again. so it's all really interesting stuff. So there's an interesting example you share of how our brains light up. You say that eating food should be enjoyable. You say sex, great music, delicious food, all light up the same circuitry in our brain. Talk to us a little about that, if you would.
Yeah, that's correct. And that was a big part of my perspective in writing this book, because nutritional psychiatry is fantastic, and there's a lot of terrific research going on there, but there's research from all other different parts, neuroscience and this pleasure science that we're talking about, that can enhance the field of nutritional psychiatry. And one of the researchers who I talked to, Eric Stice, a researcher for Stanford, said, you know, the best thing you could do with this field is to, you know, the old story of four people touching an elephant, and nobody can tell it's an elephant because everyone's touching a separate part. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. He said, we need somebody to bring this all together, and that was my intent with this book. And the entire first chapter is devoted to pleasure and food pleasure, because pleasure is a type of nourishment. And this gets lost a lot when we're talking about using food for health, because you don't want to become so healthy but lose your emotional well-being along the way because you don't get to eat things that you that bring you pleasure. And so one of the people who you mentioned, Carla Hall, one of the other people who wrote a blurb was is the chef Jose Andres, who of course knows the healing power of a hot meal. He's traveled all around the world to help people in crisis and just literally just giving them a plate of hot food, which you can see it in their eyes. And so what you're referring to with the brain lighting up is I went through an fMRI, a functional MRI machine, while I was eating three different things, milkshakes, kale juice, and wine, and looking at how different parts of the brain will light up and the importance of that food pleasure that we also see all over the place. We see it, what are the other things I talk about? I went to Cape Canaveral to look at NASA's food program and their gardening program for the International Space Station. And that, I mean, there's not a lot of space on the International Space Station, and there's not a lot of water, and there's not a lot of oxygen, but the pleasure that the astronauts get from growing their food and then from eating their food together is so important to them and such a touchstone to Earth that that food pleasure needs to be primal.
Yeah, and that I think there was a meta study done on that, right? Of studies around the world, and so it's not just applied to the people at the space station there.
Oh, absolutely. And I just talked about NASA. Of course, that's the American Space Agency. The Space Agency in Italy does extensive research. The Space Agency in France, and they cook different foods for astronauts of different nationalities, because you do have those different comforts. And I talk in the book about MREs, which are meals ready to eat, which are military meals that you give to soldiers out in the field. And I looked at a lot of different MREs from different countries. And, you know, in Italy, you might have tuna packed in oil with white beans. And in America, you might have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So it really depends on on the culture. And for the Italian astronaut, they gave her an espresso machine up in the space station. So I think that's fascinating, too.
Yeah.
You need to have your espresso.
Yeah. So if you go to somewhere like Weight Watchers or an organized kind of weight loss program, they will tell you always to not eat standing at the kitchen sink, but to, you know, set a placemat and table and all that stuff. But it's so much more than that. You talk about how important our environment is when we're eating, and preferably we should eat with company versus eating alone. Not always feasible for people who live and work alone, but that would be the ideal, right?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be all the time. I mean, the most important thing that I took away from all the research that I did is that all of this is about patterns. It's not about doing something all the time, and it's not about, you know, one or two superfoods, like eat this food and you'll be fine. It's about the patterns that we have. And I live alone part of the time, and I really have to make a concerted effort sometimes to eat with other people. But I do because of something that I call the feast paradox, which is when we think about eating, we think to ourselves, well, if we eat less, we'll have better health outcomes. And there's some science around that. But the interesting thing is that the people who eat with other people eat more food, but they enjoy better health outcomes. And so that's what I wanted to get at in that pleasure section, is what is it surrounding food that really makes it that tool for emotional well-being? And whenever we eat anything, our brain releases dopamine, and that dopamine helps with bonding. And if you're with other people, it will help with bonding with those other people. If you're by yourself watching a television, that dopamine spurt, I don't want to say it goes to waste, because I love eating alone sometimes. I mean, I think we all do. But doing it as your pattern is associated with worse health outcomes, particularly worse mental health outcomes.
Right. And I love that you talked about how whiskey tastes grassier if you're by a window and can hear a lawnmower and birds singing, and mouthfeel is important. Cadbury's nailed the mouthfeel. You know, there is definitely a mouthfeel to Cadbury's chocolate. Go look at my fridge. It's full of it.
I love the dairy milk.
Yeah. So let's look at the relationship between the microbiomes and the brain. And we're discovering new things about this every single day. And it's been quite a while since we talked about this on the show. For those who don't know, explain what we mean by gut microbiome.
Absolutely. So the gut microbiome is the trillions of bacteria and fungi and viruses that live in your intestinal tract. And that goes all the way from your mouth all the way to the other end. And those bacteria actually help us transform food into things that the body can use. For example, short-chain fatty acids, which are critical for mental health. And those could not be manufactured without the gut bacteria that we walk around in. And what's interesting about the microbiome is that everyone has a different microbiome. It's like a fingerprint. No two are the same. At the same time, a healthy person in America will have a very different gut microbiome than a healthy person in India, simply because of our surroundings and because of the foods that we eat, the types of foods that we eat in a culture. Even somebody who eats Indian food in the United States will have a different gut microbiome, because there are a lot of things that affect the microbiome and a lot of things that the microbiome affects. So sleep hugely affects the microbiome, and then the microbiome influences sleep. Social anxiety, it has been shown to be linked to the gut microbiome. How you metabolize both food and medication. See, we all know, like, a medication might work for one person, and then the other person doesn't really feel the effects as much. A lot of that can be linked to the microbes in your gut. And so it's this whole universe that we walk around with every single day that we don't really know a lot about. We know that it is extremely influential on our mental state, on our weight, on our health, all of those things, but we don't know how. We don't have the mechanisms. And I don't think, and the researchers who I spoke with, don't think that in our lifetimes we will understand the gut microbiome and we will understand the mechanisms. But what we can do now, we understand what affects it and what helps it, and what affects it and helps it is whole foods, fiber, fermented foods, all of those things that you've already heard about, right, that we all know that we should be eating, but it's a very different why, because that gut microbiome can really influence every part of your life. It's not just about weight.
Right. The short-chain fatty acids that gut bacteria makes helps protect against inflammation, I understand. And of course, we know that chronic inflammation is bad for our physical health. It's also, you say, can wreak havoc on our emotional wellness. So let's look at some of the foods. I think, you know, some of the common foods we think of are berries and the green foods, all the colored foods. But what kind of foods should we be incorporating to help that gut bacteria?
Yeah, it goes back to a pattern of a whole foods diet. And so then if you have the occasional ultra-processed food or a food that's high in sugar, your system can handle it better. So when you go to the foods, it's leafy greens, it's berries, it is nuts, lentils, fatty fish, those kinds of foods, that and olive oil. It's a lot of what has been studied is the Mediterranean diet. And the Mediterranean diet is what I just talked about, all of those whole foods. Mm-hmm. Now, the other aspect of the Mediterranean diet is, of course, a cultural aspect. The people in that Mediterranean basin are very involved in how their food is grown, or not always, but how food is grown, curated, and eaten together. And so we need to look at the body as a system and not just a container of separate parts. Like, oh, this is going to be good for my liver, and this is going to be good for my lungs, and this is going to be good for my heart. All those things are good, but we need to remember that the body is an entire system, and there's a lot we don't understand about the power, the health power, when we gather together around really pleasurable food.
Yeah. And you talk about the Mediterranean, you mentioned the Mediterranean diet, but you also mentioned the Norwegian diet too. And, you know, in those environments, again, environment plays a very big part, because they eat very differently. They don't eat on the run. They don't eat in the car like we do, as a general rule. So that plays it back into it again.
That's right, and it's also the Okinawan diet. I talk about that too. I mean, it's you're exactly right that it's part of a culture. It's not just eat these foods and you can eat a tuna steak sitting in your car driving on the way to work and you'll be fine. I mean, that's not the culture surrounding it exactly.
Yeah. So there are many probiotic products out there that claim they can kill bad bacteria and promote good bacteria, but I understand that we need bad bacteria, we need a balance, but we can't really measure it. So there's a lot of products out there which I've been told from previous guests, from doctors and researchers, that don't necessarily work. What's your take on products you buy over the counter?
Yeah, the researchers who I spoke with said the thing about the gut microbiome is that we know it's incredibly powerful, but we don't know what to do with it. Right? We know that it influences everything. We know which foods will help improve our gut microbiome, but we can't, there's no like one bacteria to rule them all, you know? And looking at the gut microbiome, which is a system, as looking for that one specific bacteria is really losing the forest for the trees, losing the bacteria for the bacterium for the bacteria, you know? And so what we really need to keep doing is using food, because food really is a perfect system. You talk about probiotics. I mean, all of those probiotics are available to us within foods. I also think about things like nuts, that people like to stay away from nuts because they hear that they're high in fat, which they are, but nuts are also very rich in vitamin E, and you need fat with your vitamin E to absorb the vitamin E. It's a fat-soluble vitamin. So we see in all kinds of ways, and all the researchers have told me, that food is the perfect system. We're just not using it. We're looking for other things, or magic bullets, or tell me what bacteria to eat. It's, you know, yeah. And it really just goes back to a whole foods diet.
Yeah, it does. And I can appreciate that firsthand. I've been trying to change my diet since the late summer, and I can really notice a difference myself. I've been eating things that I normally wouldn't eat, like walnuts and lots of avocados, which I actually love. It's made a huge difference. When the body's feeling low, when we're emotionally feeling low, what are some of the best vitamins and what's the best way for us to incorporate those?
Well, they've found an association with people who have been diagnosed with depression and low levels of zinc. And I'm not here to tell you take a zinc supplement and you'll be fine, but it's one of those things that you need to keep an eye on. And so if you're feeling down, having foods that are rich in zinc will help. And then also, you know, they found that people who are really stressed out will have more magnesium in their urine, and that leads people to believe that your body is using up magnesium to deal with stress and to deal with that pressure. And so, you know, go to foods that are rich in magnesium in those cases. But it's a tightrope a little bit, because you don't want to fall into what is known in the food world as nutritionism, which is looking at food as what's in it rather than the pleasure that you can get from it. Mm-hmm. And so it's great to have an eye on that, but it's also, it can sometimes, it depends on the personality of the person, right? That sometimes you can focus too much on the vitamins and not just like, you know, what am I going to enjoy eating right now? And those walnuts, I mean, one of the things that you can do that will really enhance food pleasure is a food ritual. So my son, when he was very little, asked me to find him a nutcracker that would actually crack nuts. And I went on this, like, because, you know, the ornamental nutcrackers that you find around the holidays don't actually work.
Right.
So I finally found a place that would give fellows, and now, over Christmas, we buy whole walnuts and crack them open, and it's such a fun ritual that it improves the food pleasure that we get from eating those walnuts. It's something funny, it's known in psychology as the IKEA effect, because people who make their own things actually rate those things as higher quality. So like when you get home and you like put together, you know, whatever it is, your dresser from IKEA, you will value it more, not higher quality, but you will value it more. And so, you know, we need to use little tricks like this to help us enhance our food pleasure. And they're really available to us.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Let's talk about plant food versus plant-based foods, because I see plant-based foods, and I know you mentioned this too, they're really highly processed.
Yeah, you know, we have focused so much on plant-based as an idea that we have lost the idea of actual plants, of eating plants. And this is not disparaging to the alternative meat industry, or, you know, everybody is trying to do what they can to help people eat more plants. But if you are an individual who is concerned with eating for emotional well-being, it's way better to go for actual plants than plant-based, because plant-based foods are sometimes actually ultra-processed foods, are foods that might contain some form of spinach or chickpea or something, but it's been processed so much that it just doesn't resemble any of the plants. I mean, you look at the plant-based food and you can't even, you don't even know what plants are in it. And so you really, I'm glad that you brought that up, because it's critical for us to go back to this perfect system that we have of food. And that is going more towards plants than ultra-processed foods.
Right. And a lot of plant-based foods I found have soy in, and I'm one of those people allergic to soy, and I think a lot of people don't really look at that. They just think it's healthy, and not necessarily so if you're allergic to something. So
I think that's right. Yeah. And it's interesting, because your gut, and we haven't talked about the gut-brain loop at all, which is this critical part of eating for emotional well-being, that there is a gut-brain loop that sends signals back and forth. We all think about the central nervous system as sort of our nervous system, the brain and the spinal cord, but the nervous system exists all over the body, and the gut has its own nervous system called the enteric nervous system, which is known to researchers as the second brain, and it has more neurons in it than in the spinal cord. And this, and the gut can send information to the brain about what's in it that is totally separate from whatever goes into your mouth. There is a gut sense that says, I have had fat, or I have had sugar, or I have had protein, that it sends to your brain, and that's where satiety comes in. And then the brain, of course, sends signals back to the gut about what it wants. And so we really need to pay attention to this gut-brain loop and remember that what we eat affects the messages that they send back and forth to each other, particularly because the hormones that go through your blood and the neurotransmitters that go from neuron to neuron are all just made from the food that we eat. That's what your body uses as a raw material to create the things that send messages to your body. So we really need to pay attention to that gut-brain loop too.
Yes, when that first started being talked about, they used to call the gut the second brain, but it seems from reading the science and your book that they're more equal than we originally thought.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's always interesting to me because, like, the brain is the one who's naming the gut the second brain. The brain is telling us it's the most important. It's like, maybe we need to, you know, fact check the brain on that one. I totally agree with you.
Here's an interesting thing. I used to have an assistant when I worked in banking, and she would go, I have to go eat, I'm hungry. And I just used to laugh at her. This was like 20, 30 years ago. And but it is now in the dictionary. Hunger is in the dictionary. So tell us about that.
Vicki, hunger is real. I'm here to tell you that.
See, I've never experienced it. So yeah.
I went to talk to a bunch of researchers who are researching something called hangry neurons. They're known as that's what they're known as colloquially in the research circles, but they are called AGRP neurons. And those neurons in our brain control both hunger and anger. And so when those neurons are activated by a lack of food, it makes us angry, because it's all happening from the same neuron. And that anger that we feel can only go away if we have food. And it's fascinating because you don't even need to have something going through your mouth. With animals, they inject food directly into their guts to see how how the AGRP neurons respond. And the AGRP neurons go down regardless of whether it goes in through the mouth or just gets injected into the stomach. So it's like there is a sensation that is happening in the gut that is 100% removed from the pleasure that we feel from food, from the taste, from the preparation, all that stuff. There's also just this inherent biological gut sense. And that's why I always say all eating is emotional eating, because no matter what you think, all these biological reactions are going on, whether you know about them or not, whether you choose to believe them or not, and whether you can use them or not. So the whole point of the book is getting to know that connection and getting to like it and getting to know how to use it.
Right. I've always felt that my body tells me when I need a certain kind of food. I'm not talking just a craving, because I could crave chocolate all day long, but what's your sense on that?
Well, it's interesting because that could be a number of things. And one of the things that I get into in the book is a field called neurogastronomy, which is neuroscience and eating combined. And the flavor that we all enjoy is created in the brain. You know, we taste on our tongue, and that's then that we all know that. Then there are the five basic tastes. Sweet, salty, sour, bitter, umami, that we can get on our tongue. But flavor is created through all of our senses. It's created through sight, and it's created through sound, and it's created through touch, mouthfeel. So it's really important to ask yourself if you're feeling that craving, like, what is it about? Is it that mouthfeel that I want? Is there some feeling that I'm looking for from that food? That was one of the most shocking things to me, is that flavor is created in the brain. It's not created in the mouth. Yeah. And it goes through that nervous system that's processing all of our emotions too. So our emotions affect how we experience food, and the foods that we eat affect our emotions. And again, we see the system that the body is not just a container for parts. It's all interacting with each other.
Yeah, pretty incredible. I was going to ask you what was the most fascinating fact that you came across, because you're embedded in this day in, day out in your work, but I'm sure there are a couple of things. Now, you've just mentioned one of them that really surprised you. What else surprised you during your research?
Well, I've been a food writer for many, many years, and I've interviewed a lot of chefs and gone to a lot of restaurants, and the things that chefs use so that you have a good experience. Again, what kind of music is playing? What does the food look like? That kind of thing. There's so many little, I don't even want to call them tricks, because they're not, you know, there's nothing nefarious going on. It's just
it's part of the experience.
Everything that they have to make you have a good experience, because that's what their livelihood depends on. So to answer the question, one of the most surprising things was how much cutlery can change your experience of food. And I went out and I tried out different kinds of cutlery, and there's a lot of science about this, but it's true that if you are using heavier cutlery that feels better in your hand, you will rate the food that you're eating as higher quality and more flavorful than if you're using flimsier cutlery. So it's like things like that that I've used in my everyday life that brings more food pleasure without even changing what you eat.
Isn't that interesting? That's one of the reasons I always like cloth napkins. I don't know why the food tastes better.
Right.
So at the back of the book, you have a 30-day kickoff plan, and each week is focused on a different aspect, whether it's microbiome, inflammation, nutrients, or the pleasure. So just give a synopsis of the 30-day kickoff plan.
Yeah, well, just as I wanted the science to be really understandable for anybody who's a non-scientist, I wanted that kickoff plan to be accessible to people who are not dieters, which I am not. And so that 30-day kickoff plan just takes the science and translates it into what am I going to do? What can I do on the ground to really incorporate this in my life? And for people who get turned off by 30-day kickoff plans, please know that the first week is all about increasing pleasure and increasing your food pleasure and ways, like little things like the cutlery and that kind of thing. So it's a kind of 30-day plan that you can do no matter when it is. I mean, some people would think, oh my gosh, doing a 30-day plan right before the holidays, there's no way. But it's not the kind of thing that you have to restrict yourself. It's something that you can incorporate, such as for the gut microbiome, you're just eating a fermented food every day and taking a look at your fiber intake, and that's it. And so, but these are things that seem small, but they are critical to creating that eating pattern that we know we need for emotional well-being and food.
Yeah. Well, the book is called Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being. Where can listeners find more information about you? I know you're on Twitter. I didn't have a website for you.
Oh, my website is marybethalbright.com with some of my work that I do at the Washington Post. But the book is available everywhere. I am on Twitter at marybeth and on Instagram at mary.beth. And it's available everywhere, and I'm really proud of it. Amazon, independent booksellers, Barnes and Noble, everywhere. So hopefully people will check it out and get something from it.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Chef Jose Andres earlier, and he said, by understanding food holistically, we can unlock its potential to improve our physical and emotional well-being, and that's what this book is all around about. Incredible information in here, Mary Beth. How long did it take you to put together?
Well, I mean, really, I've been following the research for 15 years. Since I read that first, there was an article that came across my desk when I was at the Surgeon General's office in 2006 about omega-3 fatty acids reducing aggression in men. And ever since then, I thought, wow, this is hard, peer-reviewed science, and I'm just going to keep going with it. And the researchers in the world have behaved well because, as you said, there's no lack of research on this. And the book has the research through 2022. So that's really great, too, that it's a very, very current book because the science, as you said, is always changing.
That's right. And, you know, we barely scratched the surface. We barely scratched an intro into the book here. So is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners that we haven't discussed today?
Yeah, that all of these studies that we looked into with people who changed their diet, the improvement in their emotional well-being or mental health happened independent of weight. That you can be a person who loves food and who eats well and who eats healthily for emotional well-being. And I think that the way that we've conflated food and weight, in the same way that we've conflated food and exercise, is a disservice to people who are really interested in eating well but don't want to, but feel triggered by, you know, focusing on weight loss or that kind of thing. So I think it's a really freeing message, and I hope it is for other people.
Yeah, love it. Well, I really enjoyed it. There's a lot of information in there. I still need to finish up some of it. So I really appreciate you being with us and sharing your expertise with us today. And I love the quote at the back by Agatha Christie: when engaged in eating, the brain should be the servant of the stomach.
Always, always, Vicky, always.
It's been such a pleasure. Mary Beth Albright, the book is Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for the time.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, I'm Carson Kressley. Of all the resources in the world, kindness is the most precious. For more than 140 years, American Humane has been working to protect animals in disasters, on farms, on the silver screen, and in zoos and aquariums, caring for the world's vanishing creatures. You can help too by making humane choices every day. Visit AmericanHumane.org for simple ways to build a more caring and compassionate world for all of us.